Welcome to The Business Show. We believe that our journey through this world is one we must take together, expanding, learning, and growing as a united force. We know that history is being made right now, and the decisions we make today will shape our tomorrow. These decisions will not only impact us, but will define the future for generations to come. If we don't make the right choices now, we risk creating a future we don't want. That's why we're here, to slay the dragons of the modern world and to face the challenges it brings head on. The future demands that we come together to tackle these challenges, and the only way forward is through unity and collaboration. Let's rise together, undivided but united. Let's face it, sustainability is complex. The sustainable revolution is upon us. And there are so many challenges that we are faced with that we need to try and resolve. And the only way for us to understand that is through having critical conversations. That is why our ESG webinar series is doing exactly that. We are having conversations about the complexities, the systems that needs to change, and how we all can contribute to bring about change. As you all know, I am very passionate about marketing and really exploring the world of sustainable marketing. And what better way to do that to be joined by ESG specialists and sustainability specialists, and really to understand how stakeholder collaboration is vital in order for us to tackle the critical intersections of sustainability and marketing, exploring the complexities and business models, consumerism, and the real-world impact on our lives and the planet. We are joined by one of South Africa's renowned sustainability experts, Shimila Subramani. She's also the CEO of the National Business Initiative, but also has been awarded as a Sustainability Professional of the Year in 2021, and really drives the impact not just on a local level, but on a global level. Then we are joined by Helen Neal. She is the founder of HN Communications and a multi-award-winning sustainability communications consultancy that really drives about change and good communication that can drive impact not only within an organization but within the world of sustainability. And then joined by my colleague, Kalnisha Singh, who's a developmental economist, a creator of transformation and sustainability and strategies that lead to meaningful societal change. And then myself, a connected marketer, founder of Carmen Murray Communications, and then also the founder of Conscious Leaders. Together, we are going to tackle this conversation, a necessary conversation. And please share your perspectives and let's learn from some of the most brilliant minds in sustainability and marketing. And let's redefine the role of how marketing can also drive positive change when we collaborate with our stakeholders. Enjoy. We have another philosophy. We build the ark and they will come. So one day we'll be a bigger community and we're growing one day at a time. We are over 3,000 corporate women on our database so far. So we're very excited in how this community has been growing in the past 6 months. So a warm welcome to everybody and let's begin. Kalnisha, are you ready for today? Always. I've been holding this one up because I was like, oh my gosh, I must try not to get too emotional about it. Okay. All right, without further ado, okay, so I would like to perhaps tackle this today differently. So first of all, Shimila, you are probably one of the most respected people within the ESG landscape here in South Africa. And you have traveled all across the globe to go and study it, to actually come and implement it here in Africa. And I think that Africa, and specifically South Africa, we come with such a rich history and so many challenges as well within this landscape. And your contributions will be super valuable. Helen Neal from the UK, is also a force of nature. She's also very involved and she's actually a sustainable marketer. Now, what's interesting to me is that's not really a big terminology that we have over here, where people have the bravery to call themselves only a sustainable marketer. There is a few, but I mean, it's not
democratized, if I can put it that way. And sustainable marketing has so much work to do, and I would love to hear your input and how implementation is happening across in your world, from New York and arranging some of the biggest events and all the way to the creativity festivals. It's going to be fascinating to hear your input. So a warm welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carmen.
Very excited.
Okay. Very. And then Kalnisha, I'm going to start off and I'm going to give the lay of the land as I see it for now, just to build on, and then you build on it. And then it's over to you ladies to shake the trees. Right. So historically, marketing has played a role in driving consumerism by promoting a culture of convenience and disposability, right? The focus on fast innovation and rapid production cycles, which means, today all we do is innovate and then today's innovations end up in tomorrow's landfills, which is a big challenge that we face. If we also look how rushed the market is, so products and services gets developed just like this, and then tomorrow we need to get it out to market, we need to bring in the revenue, bring in the ROI, and it makes it very difficult to actually start asking the important questions, because marketers, I feel, are almost involved only at the end of the process, and asking those important questions about sustainability becomes an interesting dilemma to face. The other thing is also the marketing functions. One of the trends that we are seeing from our side is that the marketing functions was usually where you could be creative, you can look at a problem and find a solution for it in a very creative manner and use all of the tools and the technology to your disposal. But where we find ourselves now is where marketing and sales are merging as departments. And when marketing, especially for global companies, well, I know for a fact that it's happening here in South Africa, but global companies get given a strategy that's implemented on a global level and say, localize it, and then implement it. So the inputs and asking the questions, are we greenwashing? Is the product actually really ethical? Are we doing the right thing? Is this, where is the waste go, and all of those kind of questions is also something that's a difficult scenario in that regard. Then we're also tackling the state of consumerism today. We're not asking the questions. I had an interview a few months ago with a big retailer, and one of the things that was really interesting to me was, in terms of consumers, who is responsible to educate them? Is it the brand's responsibility? Is it global organizations and institutions' responsibility? But where does the buck stop? And or is it the consumer's responsibility to do the research? How does this work in a level of ethics? And then also looking at shared responsibility and ethical consumption, we must ask ourselves, is the sustainability solely a marketing problem, or is it also the fact that these products and services, we are just pushing and panting and saying, buy now, and we are conditioning our consumers to buy all the time. Is it in a company's favor to educate a consumer, to say to them, hey, we don't need you to be educated, because at the end of the day, if we educate you, you might not buy our products. So if it's not ethical, but if it's ethical, then you have no problem to share it. But this is also where the dilemmas become. It becomes very complex. And I think also where it gets interesting is the educated and aware marketer. You know, the ESG world is changing. So many people are not even familiar with the basic terms. I have to be honest, like, I just jumped into this ESG world because I want to be part of it. I don't have all the answers, but I know that there's so many of us that don't have the answers. Yes, rightfully, we've always been fighting and chasing for shared value, but also there's so many things that can't be changed from a marketer's perspective. It needs to be changed on a organizational level. How do we find a way that we can bring our skills to the table and do amazing things together, but understanding each other's worlds? Kalnisha, over to you. What statements do you have?
So I have a few. My first big statement is I actually know nothing about marketing, right? Or all I know about marketing is like the 5 or the 6 P's that we learned about in, you know, business 101 in first year varsity. But what I also must acknowledge, so I've been in the field of sustainability and development for the last 21 years. And what I must acknowledge is the role of people like me in enabling greenwashing. Because when we started making, and I speak for myself and the businesses I've worked in for the last 21 years, and when I started making arguments for let's invest in sustainability, the only sort of basis for that argument was let's invest in sustainability because it will generate really good marketing returns. Or we could divert some of the marketing budgets and kill two birds with one stone. And that was the argument when we set out on this journey. And what we've realized is that the argument was so compelling that it has now resulted in this unintended consequence that is greenwashing and posturing for public relations interest, rather than the intentionality behind, you know, the embarking on the sustainability journey. So I think that was when I was contemplating this webinar last night, lying in bed, unable to sleep, I was like, actually, you know, it's very easy to blame them. But I also have to acknowledge my own role in the mess that we're in. And that's where I'm going to kind of stop, because I think the panelists have so much more to offer to this conversation than my babbling ever would.
Same here. Over to you, Shamila, because you're in South Africa. I'm going to start with you, that we can just have the South African context, and then we can move over to Helen.
Thank you, Carmen, and thanks, Kalnisha. Firstly, it's a pleasure to be here, and I want to, I think at the outset, applaud both of you for tackling what are brave and perhaps slightly unpopular and, you know, different, difficult perspectives, but they are critically necessary. So I want to start with maybe two framing statements. The first one is that our business models are premised on perpetual growth, or growth into perpetuity, which effectively assumes that our resources are infinite. And let's test that for a second, because I think we know that they're not infinite, which is why we're starting to have a conversation more intently around sustainability. And I think that is my sort of first framing statement. My second one is that our education systems and the way in which we practice business are effectively grown up in silos. You go to university, you study accounting. Okay, accounting very rarely thinks about systems perspectives on sustainability, on resource constraints and things like that. Or you go in and you study marketing, but you're not really understanding perhaps the fundamentals of business necessarily or what happens. And so when those silos come together in a business, the kinds of challenges that both you and Kalnisha have outlined are not then unexpected. Okay, and so I want to start with looking at that. And when we're talking about, I know you've asked me to look at a local perspective, Carmen, which I'm happy to do so, but I think the challenge which we face in sustainability is absolutely a global one. And this is where we need to understand that we are interconnected, and whatever happens in the globe is going to have an impact somewhere else. And that is fundamentally because of the systemic nature of what we do and about the complex system that supports life in its very basic form on Earth. And so when we sit back and we look at sustainability, we've got to understand that our businesses function on a planet that has finite resources, and that resources in are actually finite. We know we're moving, for example, in an energy future towards looking at renewables, but that's one clue. But a lot of what we are actually dependent on is finite in nature, is often not costed. And so what we do is that we're in a take, make, waste sort of mindset and function. And Carmen, you said that in some of the framing, and that was what I wanted to talk about as well, is that we're effectively taught to be mass consumers. And where that is what everything that we're taught, everything we look at, everything that the media is telling us is effectively what is the next best thing and where should I be? And we're starting to see where our value systems are shaped by that with which we are exposed to. And our filters to be able to say, but what does that actually mean in the context of sustainability? Is that really what I need? Is that really what I want? Is largely, you know, sort of, I think, is starting to be depleted at an alarming rate, and has not only from now. I think the consumerism we're seeing has been over decades. And so the choices that we make are rooted in those things that we need to know. The business choices that are made in how you market and what you do are then premised on that, right? A basic model that says you need to continue to turn profit after profit, quarter after quarter, and kind of like less concerned on what you need to do to get there. And so when we look at that, we kind of understand why we're in a little bit of a bind that we find ourselves in now. And it's not just a little bit of bind, it's a significant bind. I'm going to go back to what I talked about in terms of finite resources. Let's look at some data points. The WWF Living Planet report, which comes out, I think, every 2 years, the last one said that we've seen a 70% species decline between 1970 and now. That's 70% species decline between 1970 and now. That is for some of us, at least me, on this call, within our lifetime, that has happened. Now, we talk about the climate crisis, and often when we talk about sustainability, the climate crisis is the poster child for that. But the climate crisis is exacerbated by the biodiversity crisis, and that we basically we're saying, if we don't sustain that plant life and, you know, that ecosystem on which we need to operate, what we do in terms of reducing emissions, which, you know, a lot of companies are trying to do, and yes, marketing well, some of those efforts as well, is almost useless if we don't preserve the ecosystem, because we talk about carbon mitigation activities, which is trying to reduce your actual carbon footprint. But then what about those carbon sinks that exist in nature that need to absorb that carbon? And that cycle needs to support each other, right? And so if we're not concerned, for example, about the depletion to the environment, then what we're doing in carbon almost is going to have no impact. And in fact, it might be more detrimental because we're killing the sinks. And then we're not necessarily doing anything to change behavior. So that was sort of, you know, a framing that I wanted to bring in, because I think it's important in fundamentally understanding that the way in which we promote business is flawed. We internalize profit, but we externalize the cost in terms of what we've drawn down from the environment, the impact that we have in society in some of those instances as well, and we've externalized that. We just take the good we have, because our accounting systems also are not premised or predicated to be able to fully account for those costs. And so what we're incentivized to do and what we're incentivized to behave as and what we do within corporates, then we understand why that system is the way it is. And so what I'm talking about is the entire system that needs to shift. But marketing has a massive role to play in that, because it has a big role to play in consumerism, right? And in what consumers are able to see, what they understand, and the knowledge base from which they work. And so I'm going to pause there, because I know you're going to ask us more questions about that. But that, I think, as a framing, hopefully is helpful in understanding why we're at this point where this is such an important conversation, but also understanding why there isn't more of this conversation happening. I'm going to park it there for now, Carmen.
Thank you so much, Shamila.
Well said, Shamila. I thought that was great. And I'm going to pick up on a couple of the points that you mentioned. But just to explain, I guess, from our perspective, so we're based in the UK. We are a sustainability communications consultancy. That means we work across global NGOs and global corporates. We do get involved in that space around marketing as well because of communication. But I think we don't always have a very popular view, I guess, in terms of marketing's role when it comes to sustainability. So we always say that sustainability, and when you're looking at it from a marketing lens, sustainability should not be a mechanism in which you want to sell your product. So I think we mentioned earlier about the unintentional greenwashing that happens. I think what we have seen often is when marketing departments want to use sustainability in some form of mechanism in which to then sell a product, we find that often those businesses are the ones that come really unstuck. Because I think the intention about how you use sustainability is wrong. It is not there for you as a business to sell and promote yourself in that way. So then we ask ourselves, well, what is the role then of us communicating on sustainability? And I think it comes back to, and the point that Shamila made about these, the kind of silo piece, I think is a massive problem within business. You have a marketing department, you have a sustainability department, you have a C-suite. There is a level of disconnection. And a marketer's job is to sell a product. That's what they're there to do. Sustainability is, you know, in our opinion at least, it is not there in which to sell a product, but it is the responsibility of a company to do the right thing when it comes to sustainability, but also be honest that they don't have all the answers. We said earlier on, we don't have all the answers, and we don't, and that's the truth. No business, no government, no organization has the answers to sustainability in its totality. So I think it's about businesses starting to feel more comfortable about saying we don't have all the answers. And that's not a natural place for which business likes to operate. You know, it's about having clear statements, knowing how to answer the questions and being clear. So I think it's also about getting C-suites and CEOs much more comfortable with saying we've got a roadmap about how we want to get to net zero by 2050 or 2040, but we don't have all the answers about how to get there, but we're trying. And we find that that is the kind of message that lands far better, rather than you trying to put sustainability into a mechanism in which to sell products to the consumers. And by the way, in terms of global reports, there's a global marketing sustainability report that gets released every couple of years. And 63% of consumers that were interviewed have said, we see it as businesses' responsibility to sort out the problems with their products and making them sustainable. It shouldn't be a difficulty on the consumer. So if you're asking the consumer to do more things to help that business be more sustainable, whether it be the kind of recycling piece or whether it be about how you purchase the product, or it has to be something where there is no change to the consumer. The consumer rightly, in my opinion, expects the business to solve these sustainability problems within its organization. It shouldn't be a difficulty that is passed on to the consumer. And it's clear that a lot of consumers feel that way. There is a big disconnect as well, I think, between consumers who, you know, and again, it's evidenced in this report, which I'm happy to share as part of this webinar. But a lot of consumers also feel that, yes, they want to do something positive, but they really don't have anything at their disposal or tools in which to make these positive changes when it comes to purchasing of products and things. So again, I think that expectation, all too often the business looks at this as an issue and says, okay, we need to get the consumer to do X. We need to get the consumer to do Y. Actually, they need to put this problem back in on themselves more and actually ask, how do we make sure that things are frictionless for the consumer, but that we internally as a business are investing in making our products and our business a much more sustainable business. And by the way, I think you can have growth and you can be sustainable, but that takes a huge amount of change within an organization. And I think I'm seeing that in some businesses, but I think we're going to see a wave of that change because they are going to have to. And the ones that don't, I don't think are going to be here in 10, 15 years' time.
I totally agree with that. You know, I remember when the digital era started and everybody was going, oh my word, you have to migrate to digital. It's the new thing. It's the best thing in town. And I remember going to clients at that point in time and saying, listen, it is very important for you to optimize your website. We need to kind of work on your strategies to optimize your digital footprint. And clients laughed at me. And it was really like, you know, we're in Africa, people have mobile phones, it's not smartphones, people, not a lot of people are online. And I promise you, 10 years ago, some of these companies, big, massive companies that were on the stock exchange, started closing down. And 50%, I think, of the Fortune 500 is no longer around because they didn't recognize the change that had to happen. The same now applies in the era of ESG. Where we are heading is you're either going to be on this bus and travel with it, or you're not going to be part of it. I don't think it's optional. And I think companies are going to pay very big fines, and they're going to pay very big bills and school fees by not adopting. I think just listening to the conversation coming from Kalnisha, Shamila, and Helen, you know, one thing that really resonates with me is I think there's one thing that has really been construed about marketing is that we are just a sales function and all we're responsible for is sales, because ultimately that's what is expected. And I'm gonna first, before I elaborate, just explain what's happening right now online. So first of all, the first thing that happened was we said, okay, right, you've got a KPI, you have to bring in a certain amount of ROI and sales need to happen every time you do a marketing campaign. That is what we need to see. When you receive a brief from a client, the client would always stipulate that the main objective is it needs to result into sales. So what happens is you ask questions, even at your tender processes and pitches, you ask the questions and you say, okay, right, you know, what is there other objectives? Can we, what are other KPIs we can look at? And it always comes back to how much sales are we going to make out of it? So then we take it into the digital world and every company, you can see it through the advertising spend and what's happening online. Everybody's doing the same thing. It's a copy paste scenario out there. So what's happening is now it's creating another systemic issue for us because now every consumer has become a marketer because they've learned worst practice from us. They're becoming these pyramid marketers. They're also advertising, desperate to leave their jobs. They're not happy in their jobs because of quiet quitting. Now what happens is they come back and they start their own businesses, start their own education consulting thing, advertise. That's a big scam. And what's happening, it doesn't matter what industry you're in, where you're advertising, what your campaign is, if it is not done correctly, you are damaging your digital footprint. So now what's happened is South Africa's got one of the most highest ad blocking rates in the world, which means we already only have 60% of our online population. Now you take, say, I think 40% away from that 60% online community. It's now a smaller community, and now everybody that does something wrong globally or locally actually minimizes the community that we can talk to. And then we also have to add the level of digital detox and doom scrolling and all of these things that we're witnessing. So there is something fundamentally wrong with this approach of saying, and to Shamila's point, to say, hey, hang on. We need to just focus on sales, and that is the output that we expect from you. And what is really happening at the core is who's doing the education? Who's building the connections? Marketers, I believe, is there to actually build relationships and to build connections and to all the information that both of you have shared. I think that the customer experience is all about that, is nurturing and holding a customer's hand and being the voice of the customer. But being the voice of the customer is a very difficult thing when the business models are flawed and nothing can be done about what you're sharing. If the voice of the customer is not going to bring profit, it's a problem. So I can see Kalnisha's going, huh. So, Shamila, I'm just going to start with you again. If we look at this, is there a way, looking at all these challenges that we have, to almost meet some sort of compromise and say, okay, right, if this is the business model, is there maybe in the innovations model world, you know, the innovations model of 70, 20, 10, if we say 10% of our budget, let's try something that we can work on together and see if we can build traction and somehow build reporting or rapport within the business to justify more budget. And I hate to bring up the word budget, but it is necessary to justify more budget to actually create a more sustainable marketing strategy.
Yeah, and I think it's not so much about the marketing strategy, but about the fundamentals of the business, right? And because I think you can sell the story if you've got a good story to tell, and that, you know, and you that story is going to stand up when, you know, an activist comes and asks you, but hold on a second, you know, this data point are not aligning. Is there something going on here? So Carmen, yes, I think what we first need to do is to be able to just understand that there is a challenge in sustainability. And even in that, I think, you know, sustainability practitioners, we should put our hands up and say that I don't know that we've actually contributed to making it easier to understand what sustainability means in the first place.
Yes.
So we have a bit of a terminology and a understanding barrier in some instances, you know. And you'll see in a business, you go and ask one person what sustainability means versus somebody else, you likely are going to get different perspectives. And here the thing is, I don't think any of them are wrong, because it is multifaceted and the issues are systemic in nature. And so the different perspectives that people see are all valuable perspectives. So the first part is having that conversation about what sustainability means and what that business's role might be in that broader landscape and how it can contribute and how it can start becoming more sustainable. If I had to have my way, I would advocate that education in sustainability starts at primary school, and that we start building up from there, and it becomes part of your life orientation or whatever the subject is that will help us to start understanding how we exist and what that means. I mean, you know, environmental education, for example, is not new. It's within curriculums and things like that. But what does that mean in the choices that I'm going to make? How does that affect me as a consumer? How does that affect the career choices I make? But how does that start shaping me as a leader who at different points is going to start taking decisions within a business? And then within the various disciplines that we often study, you know, to build careers and businesses, are we actually understanding that? And I don't want to make it over complicated because it is a complicated subject, you know. That's why we actually have people specializing within sustainability, because you really got to start understanding how multifaceted it is. You know, one of the terms used as shorthand for sustainability is ESG. And please, I am not conflating ESG with sustainability. That's one of my bugbears. So if you look at ESG, I mean, even that, right, all the topics that we cover when we talk about an E agenda and an S agenda and a G agenda, each of them are quite complicated and would require a person to spend a lot of time to understand. But putting them together and understanding how they actually relate to each other and therefore towards, you know, sort of moving towards more sustainable outcomes, you can see is not an easy task. But we can start with the basics around we function within a planet of finite resources. There are planetary boundaries that regulate the functioning of the Earth systems. And if we want to keep a stable operating context and a livable planet, we need to understand that we've got to operate within the context of those boundaries. We also then need to meet basic societal foundations, you know, and that we need to meet the basic needs of society within the context of these planetary boundaries. And does that trickle through? I mean, how much of that do we understand? I would argue that should be basic knowledge for all of us, right? To just understand we operate in the system. What does that system need? How does that system work? And therefore, our life is actually dependent on that system. Our livelihoods are dependent on that system. And by the way, we have a responsibility to ensure, you know, adequate social foundations within the context of these boundaries. One of those that sort of trickled down a bit more easily has been that of, you know, climate change. And what is that? The boundary there is the CO2 capacity, absorptive capacity of the Earth and, you know, of the operating context that we have. And so that's translated into saying we've transgressed that boundary. We know now that we're functioning outside of that limitation, and most of these boundaries have been quantified. So I encourage people to go understand what planetary boundaries are. What does that mean in terms of just general life? We, like I said, the easier one, because it's been quantified perhaps better than the others, and you know, we have more knowledge around it, and that is the CO2 boundary. But there are many others. You know, there's nitrogen oxide, there's fresh water systems. There are a few others that we really need to understand. And over the last period of probably a decade, we've actually moved into breach on a number of those. And this should be deeply concerning for each of us, because that does affect and impact our life as we know it and our life going into the future. You know, we talk about a climate emergency, but there are a number of other emergencies happening at the same time. So, Carmen, there I feel like the education element is critical in just understanding where that is, because it is necessary knowledge for all of us in every field. We're still going to then leverage our fields and do what we can within that context to be able to say, well, how does that then relate back to sustainability? What should I be aiming for? How should this business model be evolving to start moving towards working within the context of boundaries, right? Does that mean, very difficult and uncomfortable question, I need to start rethinking about that return? Is that return of 10% per year or that growth target actually reasonable, right? Let's bring it a little bit closer to home. We all, you know, likely have pension funds, and we're on this conversation hopefully because we're supportive of the sustainability agenda and we really want to do something to shift our behavior and the businesses in which we work. When you open your pension fund statement, when you look at the bottom line, I'm going to take a guess that most of us are going to say, how much has my money grown? I don't care. I just need to know that that money's grown, right? Am I going to have a comfortable retirement? But do we stop to ask, where is it invested and what was done in order to achieve that growth that I'm looking at on there? So that's their personal take out of the context of everything, but it's likely invested in companies that had to do certain things to make that profit that contributed to the return that you're seeking. And so we are consumers, we are also investors. And how we think and how much knowledge we have can actually start changing that. Because if we start asking the right questions of the companies we're invested in, the asset managers that invest on our behalf, we can start actually spurring on better conversations by just being more conscious. Yes, we can become more conscious consumers. And Helen, that's where I perhaps slightly differ on your point about consumers want to say, actually, it's the producer's responsibility. But I'm going to say that consumers have huge power in the power of choices, asking questions, and the knowledge that they can have to actually spur on the action that those businesses can take to do the things, you know, you're so clearly articulated need to be done. And so we mustn't forget that that's where that lies as well. So businesses can do that. Businesses can be able to say, what are those things I need to affect and impact, and how do I do those? How do I educate people? And we shouldn't see education as a threat, because there's the other side of the coin that could say that I don't want people to know too much, because then they're not going to buy my product, or they're going to ask too many questions, and I can't change quickly enough to be able to meet the demand of that changing consumer perception. But then marry that with some of the trends that you've outlined earlier on around, you know, increased social media usage. The speed at which knowledge can be shared now is just on steroids. So even if you think that you know that you can hide certain things, or we might not be able to, we don't want to educate, for example, and I'm going to say trust that most of the businesses are not in that category and do want to be able to be honest businesses. But if we do that, understand that it's going to catch up more quickly than it did before. Whereas previously you relied on the news and maybe you'd know next day or in 5 weeks' time. Actually, now it's instant. How quickly do things go viral? Particularly bad news. You know, let's look at those trends and marry that with the need to be able to say, we've got to move with responsibility more quickly, and we've got to do that understanding that the consumer on average is actually going to become far more educated far more quickly than they did in the past. Then marry that with the trends that we're seeing when we're looking at intergenerational differences in consumption patterns, in needs and things like that. If we look at just the stat on millennials, and I believe millennials are already old news, but I'm going to go there because that's the one I know, right, is that they're starting to ask questions more and more. They're starting to select employers based on how they behave and act, and are making choices of what I want to work for somebody who I think is doing better. They are also going to become the inheritors of massive intergenerational wealth. They are then going to become the investors of the future and are asking different types of questions than perhaps we did. And those questions are aligned with being more responsible. Yes, they're also the selfie generation, so I'm not sure how we marry those two. But those are the kinds of trends we need to start looking at, how they feed together, and seeing that that pattern and that shift is going to come, and that businesses, it is in their interest to actually move, because even if they strip out sustainability, the needs of your consumers, the interest of your market, the questions of your investors are actually going to shift pretty quickly right now. We in fact are already seeing regulation come up. Helen didn't mention it, but I'm sure she will. We're already seeing regulation, like in the likes of the UK, looking at greenwashing, right? There's going to be called out. You're going to be fined for doing it. So that is going to shift behavior as well. So there's a lot that can be done. I think listening to your consumers, but taking the lead and understanding that those perceptions and those needs change quickly, and we need to be able to be on the front foot of those. But actually, doing the right thing and doing that in the right way and being honest, completely to Helen's point, is actually the way that you're going to get there. But then education, both of your consumers, of your businesses, and I think making sure that across the board there's at least a baseline understanding of sustainability is going to make sure we can bring all of our best assets and our minds in different fields together to help solve a challenge that is the largest challenge of our time, and that is ensuring that we actually have an existence to look forward to in the next few decades.
Helen, fire away.
Wow, yeah, I've been making notes furiously, actually. Yeah, thank you. I think loads of great points there. So there's a couple of things I wanted to start with, and I wanted to just share a couple of, I guess, real-world examples as well. So I think we talked a little bit about, you know, business structure, and the way business is structured at the moment is not necessarily fit for purpose when it comes to them being sustainable. So there are a couple of things that I have seen and that we've experienced with some corporates who are kind of really pushing the barriers on this a little bit and doing a bit more. So we've seen a couple of businesses where they have actually put in a internal carbon pricing for their business. So this is interesting. So what this means is as well as a business making investments decisions based on a monetary value, making capex decisions, etc., within that multinational, they are now also having a carbon price. So when they look at making big investment business decisions, or any decision for that matter, there is also a carbon price that has to be calculated against making that decision. This is really important because it enables whichever department you are in to actually start thinking in a sustainability way. So one of the things that bugs me actually is that a lot of businesses will have, if you're lucky, a sustainability person or a small department. But I think to Shamila's point earlier, this silo issue is a massive problem. So if you've got your sustainability champion on the one hand, doing their job in a little office, trying to push this whole monolith organization forward, it's a massive challenge. You have to put sustainability so that it transcends every aspect of a business organization. It needs to become part of the culture. So that sustainability, that carbon pricing, I have seen has actually had quite a positive impact in getting different departments to think about sustainability more. So that is a positive action forward. In addition to that, there are also a couple of companies who have been super brave and they have aligned their C-suite bonuses to carbon pricing targets. So they have to be able to reach certain points in terms of the kind of carbon pricing as well within their organization in order to meet certain levels so that they can access their bonus at the end of the year. And let's be honest, money talks within businesses and bonuses. And so again, it's about trying to get sustainability fully embedded across your whole business organization. So I wanted to share a couple of those practical examples that I'm seeing some companies starting to do. And I think we will see more of that as the kind of the world continues along this journey. So I think that was one point. I think the second point I wanted to kind of pick up on from Shamila's point was that I'm going to be honest, sustainability as a topic can be super boring. You know, there's a lot of technical data. There's a lot of complexity. It's very, very hard to communicate sometimes. And so I think that when a sustainability lead is with a marketing lead from the get-go on projects, this is when we can see some really positive output because the sustainability person and the marketing person can come together and they can work on a narrative together from the get-go and that they can see that whole project through. So that it means that if a marketing person decides that they want to put a nice windmill on their product to show that it was made with renewable energy, you'll have your sustainability person say, okay, but has that been verified? And where do we have the data? And how are we going to publish that data on our website if a consumer wants to go and find it? These are questions that rightly a marketeer is not necessarily going to ask because that's not their skill set, but it is the skill set of a sustainability person. So we have to break down these silos, to Shamila's point earlier, to bring these two sections together when we're talking about marketing and sustainability. And then the final point I wanted to just, I guess, respond back to is around the education piece, which I think is super important. And I think one of the things that I have seen work super well is in the NGO space. They are brilliant at communicating in a lens that is not to sell, but to educate. And I think that corporates could do a lot from learning from how NGOs communicate on sustainability. This is about education. This is about saying these things are difficult, but look, here are some examples of what we are doing. We're not there yet. And sharing that education and that learning in a way as not as a mechanism to sell, but as a responsibility of you as a corporate, as a business, a responsibility to you, to your consumers, to the country that you operate in and to the planet. It's the right thing to do to be able to share this information in an educational way to support consumers, to help them make choices. And I think, you know, we do find there is a disconnect between consumers. They want things to be sustainable, but in reality right now, people don't want to give up some of those easy ways of life that we're all used to. And that's a fact. That's reality. What we need to do is we need to think as businesses and marketers, how do we make it far easier for our consumers to be as sustainable as possible? And we have to put that challenge back on those marketers and the innovation teams who are building the products to think about that a lot more, I think, going forward. So those are the couple of things I think I wanted to share based on Shamila's points.
Carmen, can I just also just add some on that? So you know what Helen was saying is something that I always call, if I have to have my one line, is like, how do we make sustainability sexy?
100%.
Can we do it? Right. And because that's really what we need. We need to use that marketing engine that can sell anything to sell that is sustainability is sexy. And on the point of examples, I mean, you know, I have the privilege of leading an organization that sits at the intersection of business and philanthropy. And our job is really that, is to help with some of the fact base that will help drive better decision making, but to look for the spaces where collaborative action is possible. Because many of these challenges that we're talking about are not up to one company or a few set consumers to shift. It will require an approach that is collaborative. I mean, I want to say an all of society approach, but I'm going to limit it to the space I play in, which is in the business space. And by that, I mean, you know, if you take a sectoral approach, let's just take one challenge. And sorry, I'm following the chat. Thank you, Natalie, for the lovely points that you're putting up as well. Take the plastics challenge and the recycling challenge, right? That's not one company that's going to solve that. Yes, there are probably two or three massive companies that, you know, have a lot in terms of a packaging footprint, for example. But if we don't think about where can this be done? How is this done? What are the collection points? How do we get that going? How do we start embedding a circular economy? Can, you know, we look at waste in one area to be an input into something else, for example, and start changing the perception of a kind of a linear take waste, make waste model into a more kind of a circular model and a step further into what we call regenerative. And we're not going to go in that, probably a theme for another day. But, you know, how do we start doing that in practical ways? That's where you can say there's a space for collaborative action. And for sectors to come together and say, as a sector, this is a challenge we face. What can we do together by pooling those resources? And where's the space that it's safe for us to cooperate? Because, of course, there's always the competition question as well, right? So I want to say that this kind of, where's the co-opetition opportunities, where we cooperate for all of us to prosper because we're actually contributing to greater good. We're helping with planetary issues. We're helping with social issues. And all of our companies actually can prosper in that context that we choose to actually elevate in its entirety. And so those are the things, for example, that we do. I'm going to give very practical examples very quickly. We look at the energy space. You know, one of the big things we need to do if we're going to reduce the CO2 footprint is to be able to ensure that we move and we change our energy footprint and our energy mix from to be able to incorporate more and more renewables going into the future, looking at the global goals, for example. But those are sectoral, even national approaches that need to happen. How do we contribute? How do we do that? And we would do things in that space that says, a big blockage might be the ability to do virtual wheeling, right? What can we do with companies that can do that, pilot that, work together between government, business, and society to get that done? So collaborative action, definitely. The other part is absolutely, and follows on a little bit of what Helen said, which is how do you find the good examples and elevate those so that it becomes easier for others to start taking action? Because if you look at the challenge in its entirety, I guess one of the concerns is that it's so massive, I'm just going to throw my hands up and say I can't do anything, which is a reality, by the way. You know, in some instances, even in climate change, this whole kind of practitioners giving up hope and being depressed because the problem is so massive is actually a thing. It's a real thing. Mm-hmm. And so how do we make sure we keep hope going? By finding those things that can generate those wins, and sharing examples is a very powerful tool. So it's something we do as well. We find those examples, we make sure we share them, we get CEOs who are committed to talk about that, to highlight those examples, to get them going. We get people to try and get, you know, communities of practice together who can share that. One of those that we've been doing recently is, for example, with chief sustainability officers or people just working in that space to say, what are the challenges you're facing? And can you have a safe space that you can talk about those? Because that's the other thing, right? Can we just talk about it in a safe space? You know, I'm having a challenge. I don't know how to get my executive to buy in. They're not walking the talk. And they might feel by sharing that they're putting their company in a bad light. Actually, no. Many of us are in a similar space. And largely because of the challenges I've outlined before, the model is not favored for that, but we can still do something. So those are some of the practical ways. There's sectoral sort of engagements that can help with issues that are particular to a sector. There are intercompany exchanges that can happen with things that are cross-cutting. There are communities of practice. Find two or three people in the space that you can talk to and just say, how do I deal with this? Can I deal with that? And so we must normalize information sharing and problem sharing with the view to say, how do I solve this challenge? So those are the, and then this intersection of business and philanthropy is an enormously powerful one, because there are things that philanthropy can do that are not in the interest of business or wouldn't fall within their traditional model, but that can shift the thinking and the behavior that can then easily be adopted within a business context. There are operational constraints that a business has that philanthropy can learn from and say, well, I can try and use this money to untangle something like that in a way that can take a broader approach. So those are some of the things I can do. I can say are practical ones we've seen being extremely useful. You know, it's an organization we work with that are companies that are wanting to collaborate in sustainability and shifting the dial, including social transformation, economic inclusion, and the like. And so I can say that there is so much that is possible when people want to come together and show those. And they might seem small at the beginning, but trust me, they are catalytic in the impact when they work together. And it's sharing those good stories that are perhaps the right step for us. We understand the challenge, but we share the good stories because hope needs to be upheld. And come in the last one, I mean, your whole series is premised on this issue of trust. And you know, and you probably touched on it before, but there's this amazing work that's done by the Edelman Trust Barometer, yes. That is an annual piece of work that measures, you know, the level of trust that society has in each of business, government, the media, things like that. And you've seen over time how, understandably, I think trust in government has become eroded. I think that's a global phenomenon, and in media. And in government, so we've seen those things happen. But interestingly, we've seen the growth in trust in business increase. And in some instances, people have called that almost counterintuitive. But what that means is that there's a big responsibility put at the door of business to act sometimes even outside the bounds which it sets for itself and what it thinks is its responsibility. But that is also a huge opportunity for leadership and for shift, which means that the expectation is that business is part of society. And therefore, your actions are there to promote the better interests of that society actually on which you depend for your profit. And so it's a huge opportunity to rebuild trust. And I think sustainability is one of those agendas that can really make a big inroad in that regard.
Kalnisha.
So, I mean, the conversation has been so thought-provoking. And I think for me, I always have to bring it back to the work that I do, right? And there's so many like intricate challenges in the sort of sustainability narrative and implementation, particularly around sort of local underserved communities on the continent, right? So Africa is seen as the next big market because we have 700 million people that have never had economic access. So it's all of this untapped demand, right, that marketers are trying to now tap. And the challenge that we have there specifically from a consumerism perspective is that consumption is an ambition for most people who have never been economically served, right? It's very easy for us to dress in our nice clothes and wear our jewelry and drive our cars and tell people to not consume because we've had the privilege of consumption.
Sure.
To someone who's never had the privilege of consumption, how do you tell them to then not consume? Right. And that is a big challenge that we have on our continent. The other like fundamental challenge that we see in the sort of ESG sustainability narrative is around the languaging, because it's not, and it's a conversation that we commonly have, is that the models within which we work weren't developed for us on this continent in the emerging markets. These models were developed in universities in the global north and then imposed on us. And the translation is not as easy to translate climate change strategies, climate mitigation strategies into a like hyper local reality is very, very difficult because the climate mitigation strategy for a rural community in the Northern Cape in South Africa might be stormwater drainage, right? It's not necessarily a carbon abatement strategy. It's a very, very fundamentally infrastructure. And this is where we're seeing a big disconnect in the narrative. Also, the fact that, you know, and so before I get too much into the doomsday conversations, I think the sort of hope that we have is that, again, in our context, the natural traditional philosophies of Africa, of the global south, are fundamentally sustainable. Right. Communities, rural communities, communities that have never had this traditional economic access or modern economic access that we think about, understand how to live with the environment, understand how to live in a circular nature, understand how to adapt life as the climate changes. Right? It's only those of us that live in this formal economy that struggle. And for me, the big opportunity now is about, you know, building the bridges now between these two worlds, acknowledging that we have a lot to learn and we can learn a lot from those who have never had the opportunities that we've had and whose lives have been removed from this sort of perpetual growth narrative, because the solutions exist. And the big example I have in that regard from an economics perspective is this entire movement in South Africa that's happened over the last 10 years to understand and tap the township economy, right? And that drive was the realization that there is an economy that exists that's not documented in our traditional economic methodologies. And it's not documented, but it's also thriving. And if you drive into any township in South Africa, those communities, I mean, it might not seem like, or it might not be the idealistic suburban existence that we've come to picture, but those communities are literally, they're vibey, there's activity, there's action, there's, you know, never a dull moment because those economies are turning. And that's what we sort of want to, that's what the sort of township economy narrative wants to kind of understand and mimic and model and take it and profit from, right, if we put it bluntly. But that also sparks hope, the sort of, it sparks hope that there's a general sort of movement towards understanding that there are mechanisms that, that exist on our continent that we haven't yet understood. And I think the opportunity for us now is, while we're dealing in the sort of fog, is to take a step back and realize that maybe there are principles of sustainability that are already embedded in our society that we just need to surface, right? It might make it easier for us to do it that way than to try and impose these fundamentally external models and ingrain them in our society that, you know, that's just my sort of parting shots. We have 2 minutes left of the webinar.
Listen, I feel like we need more of these conversations. Like, it's been absolutely fascinating. I want to use the time to close off, and I do apologize to the chat, but basically from the chat is, you know, from Adelia, she says she loves the sentence, we need to normalize information sharing. Totally agree. We live in an age of we don't just need information, we need wisdom. On trust in government, I read an article by Natalie on how the revenue from the plastic bag levy to the tune of billions has disappeared rather than being reinvested in sustainability, which is disappointing. So resistance in the form of collective action to ensure accountability seems like a really important mechanism, because who is policing the police? Very good points by Natalie. I want to close off just by trying bringing it all together from the points that I've taken from all of you. And then I just want us to close off with a parting thought before we close off. So I'm going to try and make it as quickly as possible. Please bear with me. There's so much to think about. I think the one thing, one of the reasons I started Conscious Leaders was really trying to focus on authentic intelligence. And authentic intelligence is for me the opposite of artificial intelligence, because the whole world is geeking out about it. And I think that that's where we need to move to as well. And that consists out of cultural intelligence, creative intelligence, collective intelligence, spiritual intelligence, which is all about interconnectedness, foresight intelligence, learning intelligence, and emotional intelligence. And having those insights and really developing your knowledge of those spaces and places and where you need to have all the information to be a best, to be the best critical thinker to help solve the most systemic problems, we need to really tap into those intelligences. And what I really picked up today is we really need to work on interconnectedness. We need to understand the interconnectedness in our businesses. We need to understand it in our ecosystems. We need to understand it on a global level. How do we interconnect with international countries, you know, globalization, and also what we do here impacts everything overseas and vice versa. If we look, for example, trust is definitely always what we need to come back to. How do we build trust? Because if we don't build trust, we build resistance. We need to think like I love this. We've got to think like NGOs. If we want to do marketing, we've got to start thinking like NGOs. We need to normalize information sharing. And I think where this is also important is the cross-pollination, not just between departments, silo departments and ESG and all those things, but I think it would be a very valuable thing to do cross-pollination by understanding what's happening with the indigenous tribes and learning from indigenous tribes versus, you know, large organizations learning from them and vice versa, and having a skills pollination. It's not always getting people digitalized. It's maybe having that balance. And the other thing is, you know, how to make marketing sexy and making it sexy for sustainability. That is something that I will really remember after today, but also the collaborative approach and looking at the circular economy and how we can actually integrate. And circular economy is a term that we're all familiar with. But I think one thing that Kalnisha and I have discussed a lot over this past few months now on the ESG series is really this thing about we are so obsessed in that barometer, the Edelman Barometer Index, where it speaks about innovation, and it says specifically that people have started mistrusting innovation because we're innovating so much that people are going like, you know, I don't know if I can trust this technology or can trust this thing. What is the impact going to be on my life? And I think if we look at this evolution that is happening, isn't it sometimes time for us to stop innovating so much and actually not forgetting the old things and remembering the old things that we've done, going back to the roots? Because I feel there's a lot of things that we're missing and a lot of information that has gone, you know, gone to the grave because we are constantly only looking what's forward and never remembering what's behind us. So closing thoughts from me. And over to you, Helen, and then Shamila, and then Kalnisha, you close off for us.
Oh, just to say thank you. It's been such an honor to come and be part of this discussion with you wonderful women today. And thank you for having me. I think the big things I take away is exactly what you've just said. I think we can, and I'm definitely there on this, is that like we get caught up in the now and the future. And I think sometimes, particularly with sustainability, a lot of the answers are in our past and the things that we need to think about in terms of how we've been in the past. And I think I love the point around hope that you made, Shamila, earlier. It's something I really believe in. I think ESG, sustainability, however you want to look at it, it can feel overwhelming. It can feel too difficult. And I think it's really important that going forward, we keep holding on to hope. We always say in our team, you know, hope is a verb. It's a doing. Like we want to be hopeful. We want to go through this next stage in our humanity and our history to be hopeful and make these changes and make them in a positive way. So I think that's a big thing I'm going to take away from this podcast and session. So thank you very much. I've loved it.
Thank you, Carmen. And likewise, from my side, it's been wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for such an interactive audience as well. Wonderful to hear that, you know, the messages at least are resonating. This is one that's resonated with me.
If you don't in
the future you want, the one that you're going to get is going to be worth infinitely less. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Wow.
I'm so deeply grateful that we get to have these conversations. I think that there's so many wonderful people that are doing the work and that are interested in the space. And I think this is the first step towards sharing that information and sort of democratizing the knowledge, which we so deeply want to do, right? And so, yeah, let's just keep going, Carmen.
Shining and vibing. Anyway, thank you, ladies. Thank you, everybody, for joining. Thank you for being so involved and for really also just helping us to steer the conversation. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.